Hey everybody, time for Shop Talk Show, and it's episode number 219, where we're going to be speaking with a couple of book publishers that I'm sure you'll be familiar with in our industries. We're really going to get into the nitty-gritty, the nooks and crannies of the tech and UX and design and stuff book publishing industries. It should be super interesting. I should say this show is brought to you in part by Segment, that's segment.com, which is this middleman API kind of for lots of different third-party integrations that you might be doing on your site. Things like Google Analytics and Optimizely and HubSpot and Mixpanel, all these things that would require you to put some third-party JavaScript on your site. You just put Segment there instead, and Segment acts as this awesome middleman to send all your data to these other services. So it's really easy to turn ones on and off and reconfigure them and grab data from elsewhere and do interesting stuff with it. That's what Segment is, trusted by all kinds of companies, Trunk Club, Atlassian, New Relic, all this thing. It's really cool service. For now, Mr. Dave, please kick things off.
This is where a theme song goes. All right. Hey, Shop of Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me, of course, is Chris Coyer.
Hey, and let me introduce our book-related guests right away. We have Cattell Ledoux. Did I get that right? Hi, Cattell.
You nailed it. Hi.
Good. Hi, Cattell.
one for 200, Chris.
No. Very much. Cattell is the executive director of A Book Apart. Not a joke this time. Not that it's ever been, but Dave likes to make I'm writing a new A Book Apart jokes. And but this is for real. We really have the executive director of A Book Apart.
That's right. Time.
Yeah. Which is, as they say, brief books for people who make websites. How are you, Cattell? Thanks for joining us.
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. And we have Lou Rosenfeld from Rosenfeld Media. Hey, Lou.
Hey, guys.
So we thought, you know, it just is interesting. I think I heard from Lou earlier this year, and that I think it was directly from you, right? There's like new authors under your kind of media label publishing some great books, and, you know, maybe we should have them on the show and talk to them. And then we did that, and it was a great show. And I was like, you know, it would be interesting, too, is to have kind of the publishers themselves on to talk about that type of things. I think people are interested in it from lots of angles, not just the, you know, hey, cool, you make books happen, but the, like, what if I want to write a book, and what is the climate of book writing like, and are tech and design and UX books even a thing anymore? which of course they are. So maybe we'll start with some of that stuff. Maybe we'll hear about the labels from both of you first, like what it is that you do and how do you think of what you do, starting with you, Lou?
Sure. I don't know that I'd say books are dead, but I think publishing as we know it is, at least traditional publishing, is somewhat dead. And the way we look at what we do is that we're not in the book business, but we're in the expertise business. And so that means our job as publishers is to curate, to identify really good people, really good ideas, actually put it through our own user experience process, because we see ourselves as a UX company, and then get the expertise that we've curated out into the market in the ways that make sense. So with some people, we publish their books. Some people are on our conference programs. Some people, we represent them getting their workshops into the corporate training setting. And then some people, we do all the above. But ultimately, it shouldn't really be about any particular format like the book. It should be about the ideas and what makes sense as a way to present those ideas.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. So I'm sure that's probably a little bit of news to some people. I mean, it is to me a little bit, because I think of Rosenfeld Media as, I don't know, the nice books with the lovely covers, kind of, and I own a whole bunch of them. But it's not all that you do. There's also, you know, oh, this author is great at this X thing, so maybe they should be involved with our companies doing other things as well, like potentially doing some workshops or, yeah. Great. So we had recently we had Donna Lichaw on for doing the user's journey. If you remember that episode, audience, which was about, you know, taking like movie scripts and stuff and bringing story to the design process. So and she definitely she not only has the book, but definitely does the kind of corporate training thing as well.
Yeah. One of the things about being in this business that's really fun is I get to read these books, obviously, before anyone else does. And we get to take what we learned from these books and apply it to what we do. So, you know, about a year ago, I was using Donna's book to help develop the arc of the conference program for Enterprise UX. We had our first one a little over a year ago. Next one's coming up in 2 weeks. And, you know, an event has a story arc, which is what Donna gets into. So any kind of product has a story arc. And it's been really fun to use those ideas and really beneficial sometimes before anyone else gets to.
Yeah, I experienced the same thing on some of the products I work on. You know, it's like people are like, dude, you know, do you use some of the like CSS and stuff that you learn on your own site? I'm like, heck yeah, I do all the time. Every redesign is often a reaction of something I learned from my own site.
Well, there's the flip side, too, of course. I still get people complaining, saying, didn't you read the book Web Form Design that published by yeah. Luke Rablewski? And it's like, yeah, I know. We're not as big as Luke's companies, but okay, good point.
I think so. That was a 2008 book, and I should say, just because I have it in my notes, I have it here on my bookshelf. One of the my favorite books. You know, I know you. Earlier before the show started, you said you hesitate to call yourself a tech book publisher, but I kind of thought of it as a tech book, particularly that one, because it's kind of like what makes for good form UX, and like forms are kind of a tech thing, but. It is an awesome book still to this day. It was, you know, I was about to work at Woofoo at the time. We were all about web forms and we all loved this book. And it's still very much the, you know, kind of a Bible-like book when it comes to that stuff.
Well, here's actually an illustration of why I don't see this as a tech publisher. It certainly has a very close tie to tech, Luke's book. But the biggest complaint we've gotten, and really the only complaint, is that there's really no code in it. And our thinking was, well, you know, the code will be elsewhere. You'll create your own code. That's not really what we're about. And the fact that the book still has value 8 years later is partly because there is no code.
Yeah, it's very likely. Come to my site for the code. Get the ideas from the books. Cattell, what's the A Book Apart story? Get the pitch if people don't know what it is.
Yeah, and actually, you mentioned, you know, we make brief books for people who make websites, and we're actually kind of, you know, not rethinking that, but we're realizing that it's a little bit more like brief books for people who, you know, work on the web or, you know, I'll put it in quotes, you know, work in the digital space. And I think that just means that things are evolving and changing. So, you know, the original pitch was, you know, they're brief books, so they're around 100 to 150 pages. And the idea was that you could, you know, get on a plane in New York, and by the time you landed for a client meeting or, you know, project kickoff in LA, you would have brushed up on something or learned something that you needed to know to kind of do your job better. So that's really the pitch. And I think we also, you know, we do cover kind of tech, as Lou mentioned, as well as strategy and theory. As you can see in a lot of our titles, we touch on content strategy, and just design as a job is, you know, one of our bestsellers.
Is it really? That's some good data. I didn't even think to ask that question.
It's always a strong seller, which I think it's just proves that there's, you know, there's room for not just kind of like the tactical books and tactical content, but really about kind of like looking at how you do your job and ways to do it better, which is really awesome. And I think we're actually looking at looking at the landscape for that, you know, identifying like, are there specific topics that we want to cover? Yes, like, you know, programming languages and or you know, specs and workflows that may include apps and services and that kind of thing. But also, you know, how people apply strategies and workflows. And that's just becoming a much more important thing, because I think there is so much crossover and design and tech, you know, that piece of it are so closely tied now.
Yeah, I may need a new slogan for people who work on the web.
Yeah, or just so kind of no, like change it.
They're known for not being particularly long, and I think the Rosenfeld books too are not huge tomes. Dave mentioned this while we were chatting before the show about how that has changed over time. You know, I don't know if it's a trend or just indicative of just how people are these days. The textbooks in the history had a kind of a bad rap of being these giant things. You know, everything ever about PHP Volume 7 that you can barely carry around in your backpack kind of thing. I don't think that book would be right on either of your labels. I don't know. What do you call
the book world? Yeah, I think that's so true. It's like there was this idea that, you know, it was the definitive guide to X, or, you know, really comprehensive resource on something. And there, I think there's definitely still, you know, a place for those books. But I think this is just a little more approachable. And, you know, I think what we're doing is kind of just like getting that expertise, like Lou mentioned, you know, into people's hands, which I think is, that's like the main point.
Yeah, I just want to add to this that when I first started out and started thinking about being a publisher back in, I don't know, 2006-ish, I talked to a couple of traditional publishers to see if they wanted me to create an imprint. And I knew I was going down the wrong path when one told me, "You want to do short books? Don't you know that one 500-page book is far more useful or valuable to us than five 100-page books?"
Really?
"Oh, really? Why is that?" "Well, when it's in Barnes & Noble or Borders, the spine out is going to get a lot more attention." And wow. Yeah, I mean, it was really pretty shocking. And then we did a pretty fair amount of user research before we ever put a book out. And you know, we had the same type of use case that Gattel's describing. Someone is getting on a plane and they need to be ready when they get off that plane. Or, hey, you know, you get a few minutes here in the subway. By the end of this week, those 10 commutes, can you have actually consumed some information on a new topic in a pretty painless way? And it's not just the length. It's also things like the size of it. Can you hold it in your hand while holding the strap of the subway in the other hand? There's a lot of design ideas that go into these books, and I'm pretty sure that A Book Apart is doing the same thing, because I think our books have a lot of the same really good qualities. Short, it's about 6 by 9 inches, Gattel, right? I think it's about the same profile. A lot of other interesting, maybe not noticeable details, but when you take a deep read, you probably really notice a lot of quality details that are the signed, well-designed products.
Yeah, absolutely.
The type of books that have code in them should lay flat as well. I attempted this on a book I did a long time ago for WordPress, but it ended up not really working because the book was so big that it ended up being kind of obnoxious to be laid flat. But I always thought that would be nice, you know, for a little tech book that had code in it to like put a nice spiral bind on it, like not a junky one. Like somebody needs to like reinvent the spiral bind so that it's still nice. But I guess then you don't get the spine, right? Which that's not going to sell.
Yeah, I mean, we went through something like that, like specific to binding and kind of just the book cover. We changed over, I think maybe 2 years ago, to a paperback gatefold that, you know, has little flaps, so you can kind of keep a place in the book. And we were kind of like, why didn't we do this before? This is really useful.
It's like a built-in bookmark kind of.
Yeah, exactly. I totally get what you were saying about laying flat. That's a toughie.
And one of the things along those lines that we found in our research about bindings, before we did our first book, which was Mental Models, this was actually Liz Danzigo and I, Liz, who probably a lot of you know, is now at NPR and SVA. We did a usability study using prototypes. We actually went ahead and prototyped that first book using Lulu, and then we got into around, I don't know, 15 subjects' hands and gave them tasks and had them read it. And we looked at those prototypes at the end and saw that the bindings broke repeatedly in, you know, certain places. And that suggested that the kind of binding that might work for, let's say, a novel or some other piece of fiction that you read through and place equal stress on all the pages wouldn't work, because these are the types of books that people are going to go back to again and again to certain places. And so that did things like impact the kind of binding we used.
Fascinating. Yeah, you can't wing this, right? You have to actually do research and think about how people are going to use your book.
Well, I mean, this is what makes me a little grouchy about people think that publishers add no value. Well, in many cases, you're right, but self-publishing is not really going to help you think through these things. And I'll get off my somewhat anti-self-publishing soapbox in a minute, but there's about, and Cattell, you can join me if you like, we can pile on, but there's about 100 reasons not to self-publish, and a good 70 of them involve Amazon. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I'll just no comment that.
Amazon's the, I don't know. It's is it like a lifeblood that also is just a poisoned well, or is it's just a bunch of hurt?
I kind of want to know. It looks like you can buy both of your books on Amazon.
Oh, yeah. No, there's no avoiding Amazon. You absolutely can't not be on Amazon. But there are... a lot of aspects to the publisher experience via Amazon that are kind of light years behind the consumer experience. It's very difficult to work with Amazon, as you would expect working in sort of a B2B environment where you're the little guy and they're the enormous guy. And I'm not going to even get into the fact that, they're kind of making it hard for publishers to compete in general, which basically means in the long run, they're pissing in their own pond.
How does that compare to something, and I'm going to use modern in gigantic air quotes here, but something modern like the iTunes store, like, or iBooks store, do you find like that kind of e-publishing is good, or would you rather like people just download or buy the hard copy?
I mean, I'll speak for, for us, iTunes is actually a great kind of complement or supplement to what we sell through the site. And we actually don't sell through Amazon. Anything that you do find on Amazon are I guess, kind of like bootlegged, copies
wow.
that people bought. There's also a really fun kind of like mystery to, there's a bunch of French... No, sorry. There's a bunch of A Book Apart books that show up on the .co or .co.uk Amazon, their UK version of the website. And they're like, I think they're advertised as French, and people buy them and they're like, this isn't in French. And we're like, we're sorry. That's not us.
Wow.
So yeah, it's just really weird. Like you end up finding it, you find it everywhere, whether you want to or not. But iTunes is actually, at least for us, we kind of push our product, into iTunes and it sells there. And there's no, I guess there's just like not a lot of fuss to it. So that's really, beneficial for us.
Yeah, we haven't actually really tried that in earnest, and it's an interesting thing. I might want to follow up on that. But we've, actually we have an arrangement with O'Reilly where they basically sell all of our digital versions, the ones that we don't sell directly. They get us into a variety of channels, and I don't think they've had a whole lot of made a whole lot of headway in iTunes. But this actually, makes me think of the broader issue of, do you even want to be in paperbacks at all? And, at one point, maybe around the time like the iPad debuted, the trajectory seemed to suggest that, wow, I mean, print really might be dying. But it's kind of like radio under the onslaught of TV some years ago. It stabilized and has a role, and that role is somewhat complementary with ebooks. I mean, we've always sold ebooks along with our paperbacks from the first book we ever sold. And we've seen a steady use case of people needing to use paper for certain purposes and digital for others. And so they're often really happy they have both formats.
Yeah, we've found that too. I mean, we still see, 30% hovers around there for our paperback sales. So that's actually stayed really,
really?
Consistent. Yeah.
Oh, all the data. 30% is
much higher for us too. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're always really, surprised and pleased and happy that happens. But I think, I feel like both Rosenfeld and A Book Apart have done from the beginning a really nice job designing the actual books. You know, touching a little bit on what you were talking about earlier, Lou, because they were books for designers and developers and people who were, you know, creating this stuff, they need to look nice and feel nice and be usable. And, you know, when you buy a physical product, you want it to feel that way.
You're absolutely right. And Kitab, I'd be interested in knowing if you've gotten this one. They have to smell nice. I've had people actually say, I really love the smell of your books. I've had a few people say, wow, what the hell?
Wow.
Your books smell terrible.
I have never gotten that.
Do you do that McDonald's thing where you like test scents and you put a hamburger smell in each
one? You know, with all the usability testing and other types of testing we've done, this is the one thing we didn't think about. I guess we got lucky, but a smell counts for something.
I think kind of ink automatically smells kind of cool and good. And then I think you can lose it if there's like weird chemicals or packaging involved.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I just want a 10% grass feel.
We can customize that.
Yeah.
I remember. So let's say you're in a band, right? And you want to sell your music, but you want to sell your music on iTunes because like everything's on iTunes for whatever reason. I guess that's changing more and more. What is your path to iTunes? I'm not sure what it is for books, but I knew back then when I was trying to do this, there was no path in for iTunes. There's no public way. You can call up iTunes or email iTunes or use a web form to contact iTunes that says, here's my music. Can you please put it on iTunes? There was no way in.
Like Amazon.
Yeah. So we ended up, I was in like an Irish punk band at the time, the Groggers. And we're like, we want to make CDs because that's what you did at the time. And we ended up using a website called CD Baby because it turned out CD Baby is like kind of awesome anyway. But if you're on CD Baby, not only will they, you know, make your CDs and you know, print them and make the cover art for them and insert them into the cases for you and send you a box of your CDs, but then you're on the CD Baby, like, their website. They sell music directly through there, but then you just sell them however you want to, too, because you have them. But they had a deal with iTunes where if you're on CD Baby, you're automatically on iTunes, too. And that's ultimately, I think, why we picked them, because you're like, that's awesome. So I could imagine a book author wanting to pick a CD Baby-like thing because they're like, well, then, you know, then I'm automatically in Barnes & Noble or I'm automatically in. I don't know if that's relevant to you because you're not on Amazon, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, but for at least in terms of iTunes, I think, and I don't know about music, so I won't speak to that, but the barrier, the threshold is relatively low in that, you know, we produce something and we upload it and we, you know, we wait and hope that they approve it. And I don't think there's actually like for the approval process, it's sort of like they're checking for, a litany of things that might just be problematic for them. So if it's, you know, content that is sellable or, that they want to have on iTunes, it's fine. I think the thing that is less easy is the marketing. So you would think, you know, oh, you're on iTunes. This is great. You're findable there, but it's not necessarily like, we're not necessarily showing up in the featured books or that kind of thing. I think that's still sort of like an uncertain step.
Can I plus 1,000 something verbally? I guess I just did. I can tell you took the words out of my mouth. I was just going to say the same thing, that the distribution side is a pain in the ass. And there's certainly customer service aspects to it as well that you know, we certainly take very seriously. That said, the thing you go to a good publisher for is marketing and promotion. And those things are almost never provided unless you're, you know, like you're Colin Powell or someone like that and you just signed a $6 million book deal. There's very, very little promotional support for almost any author. And it's a shame. It used to be stronger, just as the developmental support during the writing of the book used to be stronger in traditional publishing. And I think A Book Apart and Rosenfeld Media are really the exceptions in this regard.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And, you know, as far as something like Amazon goes or other, you know, other distribution channels where you're kind of getting fed into, you know, a bigger channel, you're getting a lot of more eyeballs, which is great. You're not necessarily getting the marketing support. We actually, the one thing that we do have on Amazon that is, was sort of an organic thing, is Mike Montero actually read his Design as a Job book and recorded an audio version of it, which is really kind of fabulous. But even that, you know, we were in there, but there's no marketing support. And, you know, there's always the cut. So you're kind of like, now I'm passing on less to the author, which I think if you look at it and you've got a lot of those channels happening, so it makes, you know, makes it valuable, that's great. But if you're not quite there yet, like we're not quite there yet, I think that's why we're sort of sticking to the direct channel.
Mm-hmm. So Digging into WordPress is a book I wrote a long, long time ago. So a little bit of personal experiences. I spoke with some publishers and decided to self-publish, and it echoed all of the experiences here. It was that it was a pain in the butt, and we had to learn all of those really hard lessons ourselves rather than lean on somebody else to do it. And it was a boatload of work. And I was very kind of snake bitten by the process of it, just because I was like, that was too much. That was too much. I'm really turned off by this idea of even writing a book, because it was way too much work. And we made a boatload of money. I had a co-author on it. So it was like, because one of the reasons we went for it is because we kind of already did have some audience that we knew would be interested. We had our kind of own marketing wagon that we could jump on. So anyway,
yeah, that makes perfect sense. If you already have the eyeballs, the thing is, you kind of built a production line to put out one thing, maybe a couple things,
right?
And you know, I mean, I think the trick here is to create, as a publisher, to create a hunk of infrastructure that's just enough infrastructure. You want to really kind of straddle that line between self-publishing and traditional publishing, and to do that, you kind of got to be small. Right, you got to be nimble. You can't have 1,000 book backlist that every time the conditions in the industry change, you're stuck converting it into some new format and pulling your hair out of your head. And I think both companies, you know, Book Apart and Roosevelt Media, are doing, you know, I don't know, under 10 titles a year, and that allows us to be both nimble and to do a lot of handcrafting, kind of like a self-publishing approach, but with some infrastructure already in place. And, you know, that means, I don't know, I could tell you, I'd be interested in your take on this, but I don't think either company can ever really get big. We're never going to be doing 100 titles a year. Just that means you're commoditizing the ideas and you're not really able to adjust or be nimble.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, that is something that we've actually kind of, you know, set out and decided. We want to do it this way because we're providing that, just like you said, that you know, that enough infrastructure for folks to work with us and have a good experience and have a little bit more support and, you know, marketing and that kind of thing. And I think that is the other thing. When I talk to some authors, potential authors who are thinking about writing a book and they're thinking about self-publishing, I always want to say, well, have you considered, you know, going with a publisher, whether it's us or not? Because what comes along with that is not just support during the writing process and support during the editing process and making that book the best thing it can be. You know, you get that throughout, and that's what we're sort of starting to focus on a little bit more now, is kind of like the pre-launch support and the post-launch support and what that looks like. And I think you get that when you're small, Lou. I totally agree. You actually get that attention, whereas at a big publisher, you might, you know, you're kind of like in a lineup of a bunch of stuff in a pipeline.
Right, and just to add to that, I mean, you know, the idea of actually promoting a book, which is now kind of like in traditional publishing, they look at you like you're nuts. I mean, the promotional work actually needs to happen while the book is being written. And the kind of research that an author does, both in terms of having their work go through tech review and have other people contribute pieces to the work, and a lot of that involves others during the writing is ultimately promotion. In other words, the research and development work can be doing double duty as promotional work. So when you're getting all those influential people to read your manuscript and comment on it and offer short pieces and write testimonials and all that good stuff, that has to be designed with promotional benefits in mind as well. And so those people, ultimately, you want to have them have a sense of stake in the outcome of your work. You want them to feel like when the book comes out, it's partly theirs as well, so that they not only help you create something good, but they'll talk about it and hopefully help promote it.
Speaking of promoting this book, you're both in the market of selling books and stuff. One of the things you might fight against, I would think, is maybe it's a cliche, maybe it's just a thing that people say when they talk about tech books is, why would I buy a tech book? It's going to go out of date in 2 months. And we've touched on this a little bit, but do you find that a struggle, or do you just ignore it, or do you have things in place to deal with it?
I was just going to say, I think we definitely think about that. And we have a couple of books, actually three now, that we've released a second edition of. And those were, for sure, those were about programming and specs that, have evolved since they were first out. I think now we're starting to look at books and subject matter that looks a little bit more evergreen, and not to say that we're not going to focus on things that are still relevant and essential to what folks are doing in the industry. Like Git for Humans, I think that was really important, and everyone has the same struggle around Git and using Git and learning Git. And the way it was written was, yes, there's code in it. Yes, there's technical information in there that may or may not change. But it's also written in a narrative that kind of explains why Git is and why it behaves that way. And I think we're also looking at we actually just released two books earlier this year in a series called Briefs, which are even shorter than the brief books that we make. They're around 30 to 50 pages, and they're ebook only. So we're kind of looking at that as an experiment in terms of, like, can we put content there that actually might change a lot more frequently?
Ah, true, because there's no paper to change. Louis?
Oh, yeah. I mean, from the start, we really wanted to err toward evergreen publishing. A lot of content that changes frequently just doesn't really belong necessarily in book form in the first place. They're just better media for it. And I think for us as well, the idea of working with ideas that had legs was a way, in a sense, of defining what the field's about. As someone who's been through 25 years of DTDT conversations. DTDT is defining the damn thing, if you don't know that acronym. I want to barf every time someone tries to come up with definitions for things like user experience. It's like, you're just going to make a one-line definition and that's going to somehow satisfy anyone's needs? I don't know. I'd rather define things like user experience through the process of publishing, in this case, books, for user experience people and others who care about user experience. To me, that's an act of definition that's much more interesting than coming up with 10 words to define a whole field. And I think you get to that by focusing on the kind of big and timeless ideas. And it's just, to me, a lot of fun to focus on that.
It would seem the incentives align. You want a book on your shelf or in your store that lasts a long time. And as a reader, a purchaser of books, I don't want to read something that's out of date in 2 weeks. I think that's a big challenge, to find these timeless topics.
I think it's a little more overblown. Like, I think that if that's the reason you're not buying a book, there's something else going on there, or you're just like digesting a cliche kind of thing. I definitely have, like, I remember reading one of the influential early tech books for me, other than web form design, was one called jQuery for Designers, which is a little bit out of date by the time I was even reading it, but it was a big deal to me, and it was super nerdy, and it had tons of code in it, but it was the right book at the time for me, and in a way, it changed my life, because it was the moment in which which I went from like an HTML and CSS kind of guy to like, I'm not afraid of JavaScript anymore. And it was definitely like the right book at the right time for me that changed kind of like the course of my thing. And that's why I think books are so important. It's been a while since a book like that has come along for me, but it's not out of the question. And I'm sure all of the books that both of you all have published have been that book for somebody out there. And that's pretty cool, powerful thing. Today's show is brought to you in part by Segment. That's segment.com. Let me set the stage here a little bit for Segment. Let's say you're using some good third-party tools like for analytics and marketing and data warehousing. Really nice tools. Google Analytics, Adobe Analytics, Heap, Optimizely, Customer.io, Intercom, Kissmetrics, MailChimp, Salesforce, things like that. You need them, you know, in a variety of places across your site. That's a lot of third-party JavaScript placed around. Rather than place all that third-party JavaScript on your site, just place Segment there, and they're the middleman. They're this one API to send the data that you collect to hundreds of other tools if you want. You kind of customize the integrations of collect the data, and then where do you want to send it to, which is wonderful. It's good for performance just there, but then it makes it kind of easier to manage as well. Really, really kind of an interesting, cool idea. I'm very glad that I know that it exists now. It can also do this data warehousing stuff and pull data from other third-party sources of data warehousing, like Amazon's Redshift or whatever that. Who uses them? Atlassian, New Relic, Envision, Trunk Club, Crate and Barrel, Product Hunt, Instacart. Lots of big companies using and trusting Segment. Again, that's segment.com. What makes for, the title is so important. There's so many like aspects of a book that's so important. So when you're working with somebody new and the idea is coming together, what makes for a good subject for a book? That's kind of a wide question. But
as you could tell, I've pitched a book apart about 1,500 books at this point. So
I know. I'm
surprised
I
haven't gotten an email or anything.
You haven't gone through our submissions portal.
No one's ever linked me that. So, okay. All right.
So there's something there, though. Dave's ideas are these little off-the-hip things that are just funny. Or somebody could just be like, I want to write about PHP. And I would suspect that's not a good subject. Not because there's anything wrong with PHP, but because there's nothing there. They're just like, meh, I want to write a thing about a thing.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, as Lou was talking about sort of like the idea of more evergreen subject matter and topics, I think that is definitely something that when a proposal comes through our desk, we're kind of looking at it like, is this of the moment? Is this something that's happening right now? And if it is, should we consider it because it's really critical? Like, you know, I mean, I think we have a couple books like SAS for Web Designers. Obviously, that was really critical at the time because it was something that everyone was getting up to speed with. And it was really important that it was important to us that we provide that a book on that in our voice and kind of with our take on it. And so like a lot of that has changed, obviously. And you can even look at Rachel Andrews' Get Ready for CSS Grid Layouts, which was one of our first briefs. A lot of that has changed. And granted, that's in a format that we can easily update. But I think we are just really looking at like, does the subject matter actually say something about the, not just the what or how of something, you know, potentially it's a programming language or potentially it's, you know, optimization or that kind of thing. But why? Like, why should we care about it?
I think for us, we're certainly, we have our ears to the ground about, you know, what people are really focused on right now. But, you know, you also want to do this over the long haul and see the trajectory of interests and how they morph. So when we started out, we were really more focused on methods for doing things like user research and testing and so forth. And it's not like we don't do that anymore, but we've seen pretty clearly interests change so that while there's already plenty of books on things like techniques and methods, there's not a lot on soft skills. There's not a lot on leadership and management in our field and a lot of other topics that sort of show how the field has matured. And the reason we know about that is we engage in a lot of conversations, ones that we host through things like our own conferences, but also by attending other conferences and hearing what people are talking about in those places. And through other means as well, we actually do user research pretty regularly to inform our editorial agenda. And, you know, if you look at books are really just kind of really nicely put together, polished snapshots of broader community conversations. So, you know, again, trying to stay in those conversations and be part of them in an ongoing way is really what drives the topics that we sign.
That's such a great point. We always feel really lucky. And I think, you know, Lou, you have a similar thing going on where we have A List Apart, which is the online magazine that's a sister company to us, and An Event Apart, where we have speakers, writers, you know, people who are already in the field, kind of doing this stuff, talking about it, writing about it, and maybe they haven't written about it in a longer format, but it's so helpful to us to be able to see what that, all that stuff going on, so that we can identify like what might be next.
That seems evident to me, is that kind of a, I want to write a book about something. Well, have you written an article about it? Have you written 10 articles about it? Have you, went to a meetup and did that kind of thing? Do you have some other attachment to this thing that you like, the book is like the massive thing, and like it feels like it should be supported by littler things, which is evidence of you exploring that idea deeper.
Well, it's amazing how many people pitch ideas without any kind of evidence that they've given them much thought. I'm going to sound like a huge jerk now, so I apologize to everyone, but I'll first preface it by saying we continue to sign first-time authors. As someone married to a fiction writer who's been trying to get her books published for years, it's not really fair the way that it's a kind of a closed loop in the publishing world. We're only people who've published before get to publish. That's pretty bad. So we try not to engage in that. That said, our version of the portal for people to submit proposals, especially first-time authors, is built on the rabbinic approach. And the rabbinic approach is that if someone comes to a rabbi and says, I want to convert to Judaism, the rabbi is supposed to send them away twice before finally saying yes. And we take the same approach. It's so easy for people to say, I want to write a book, without giving it much thought, much less putting their ideas into grammar and spelling that would be close to acceptable. So we try to make it pretty difficult for someone that we don't know or who hasn't really written before to get through that gate initially. It's such a difficult thing. It's not just for our benefit, it's for the person's benefit as well. There's very little that's harder or more lonely than writing a book when you're far distant in both time and space from your users, your customers, your readers. And I don't take it lightly, and I don't really think anyone should. So we tend to be pretty tough on first-time authors, especially.
I like that rabbinic approach. I have one in my own life that if somebody like asks if they can be in your band, you definitely should say no, because they're not the person you want. it's kind of like, just don't, not the person who asked, it's the person, I don't know, who's maybe too busy for you. But I'm a blogger, I have tens of subscribers. It's a hockey stick curve. So what makes a good author then?
If we're going to turn this into advice, what's advice? If somebody's out there listening, like, I want to write a book.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to jump in and say, you know, I think that there is some advice to be had in terms of, you know, at the beginning of, you know, submitting a proposal all the way through just, you know, writing and continuing to write on something and forming an idea about what you want to write. And I think one thing is just start writing. And I know that sounds like maybe weird or crazy, but I think, you know, just start writing. And I think a lot of times when you do that, even if you have an idea in your head and you've written bits and pieces about it, and you kind of sit down to say, what does this actually look like? just putting some organization around it. I'm a huge fan of bulleted lists. I make them for almost everything and everyone hates me for it. But, you know, really just like looking at what are the main things, what are the, you know, the things that are going to come within the larger sections, and just kind of putting a little bit more thought in terms of like, who is this for? Why am I writing it? You know, what is the take that I'm bringing to this? And I think really, you know, I agree with Lou, like it's really hard to start, you know, endeavor with first time authors, but I think you can get there. It's just, it does take a little bit more.
Right. And I'd add to that and say, you know, if you're a first time author, I'm sorry to be so off putting. I'm happy to hear from you. But you have to have an open heart and an open mind. I've had experiences with first time authors where they're either not great writers or stubborn, and it's really hard when they're both. You have to be able to collaborate. We take a highly collaborative approach. Even when the proposals are getting written, we want to collaborate with the authors and help them develop the proposals that they're going to send to us. If you come to us and we're already finding that you're not taking input, that our feedback isn't really being paid attention to, that doesn't bode well for a longer and much deeper relationship. So it's just the openness that this is a collaboration and being open to that, working together, getting feedback from an editor and so forth. It's really critical.
That's so true. We do the same thing. And I have actually found that doing that in the proposal process and even that early stage is so helpful for us to kind of get an idea of what it's going to be like to work with someone, what it's going to be like to get, you know, deliveries and passes back from this person. And that's really, really helpful. And I think from both sides, you know, both publisher, editor, and author, it's a really raw process. And that's just a frank truth.
Yeah. And there's another aspect to this, which is, I don't know if you found this, Cadell, but when we get manuscripts submitted by someone we don't know, we haven't worked with, like a whole book has been written, I'm at a point where I just say no. It could be a good person, a good idea. I've had no ability to shape it, to position it for the audience out there that we work with, to have a sense of stake in it. And that's painful. It sounds somewhat counterintuitive. Someone already did the book. Why wouldn't we publish it? But it ain't our baby. I don't know who the father is, but it ain't me. So I don't know.
It is, yeah, it is tough when someone comes and says like, okay, you know, this is, I've got this fully baked. But I think back to your point about openness and, you know, kind of sussing out whether that's going to be part of the process. I think if there's room for going in and making sure that there's expectations on both sides, that this is going to go through an edit process, and there's probably going to be a point in the beginning where we might reorganize everything, or we might, you know, reshuffle a bunch of stuff, and people are open to that, I think, you know, that could be workable. I mean, we definitely, it's very far fewer that we get, you know, proposals that are here. It's fully, here's a book. So, you know, we have that a little bit less of a problem there, but.
Well, for a first time author, the expectations way off? Cause I'm like, oh, I could fart out a book in a month, or, you know, a couple weekends, you know, get some Red Bull. What is the process of a book? We like already talking about the proposal process, and then I'm assume there's a writing process, and then there's an editing process. What does that average process take?
Yeah, I think anyone who comes into this thinking I can just sit down and write a book and this is going to be easy, I 100% of the time I think that they've been proven wrong. And that's just because it's a big job, and it's really hard to put yourself out there, get feedback on things you thought were, you know, really solid, and in your head they made total sense, and now, you know, you have to kind of like rejigger things. And it's also like it's art, you know, you're kind of putting yourself out there and creating something that you really care a lot about, obviously. And I think that's why that process is so important. But sorry, to answer your question kind of in a shorter answer, is we have the proposal process, which can take, you know, anywhere from a couple weeks to a month or so. And if we sign something, then, and it's not already written, there's a writing process that can take anywhere from, you know, 4 to 6 months. We've definitely had folks decide they wanted to take a little longer or less time, and that's perfectly fine. And then the editing process from you know, what we consider the complete first draft to printing and releasing it is around 6 months. So that's, you know, give or take.
Yeah, our process is, like I said, pretty iterative early on while we're still working on a proposal. I actually collaborate quite closely with the people who are submitting those proposals. And it's almost a kind of a sprint of sorts that might happen over a month or two. I then put it in front of my advisors, my editorial advisors. So I have them evaluate a proposal. And then we share that with the author, and there's another iteration there. But it's really nice to get feedback from people like Steve Krug or Sarah Wachter-Betcher, folks like that. So it's something of an expert review. And then if we sign the book, what we find is writing that first draft, no matter what the author's intentions are, usually it's a good 9 to 12 months, and sometimes longer, because things just happen. Babies get born, jobs and new jobs begin, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, the thing that a lot of authors just don't realize is so you write a manuscript and you think, all right, light's at the end of the tunnel. Well, that's when the tech review process happens that we've carefully designed together. And that's when you're getting all the feedback from people who are really smart and know about your subject. And they may say, oh, this is great. And then you take their advice and you're done with incorporating it a month later. Or they might say, you got some work to do and you got another 6 months of work to do. Once we finally get through that, then we find that it's usually about 3 months to get it from that point to in the warehouses.
It's funny, you probably all work with people who aren't doing this as their career either, which is interesting. Some writers, it literally is their career. I'm sure very few of the authors on either side.
I think that's a thing that people also forget, and that we collectively all kind of take for granted. And Lou, you're totally right. I mean, I say 6 months because that's kind of our ideal time frame, and it's often, you know, a lot longer, or, you know, as much as 9 or 12 months. But I think that's also the thing, that a lot of the writers who write for us are doing this as a second, third, fourth, you know, side project that they've got going on. So it takes a lot out of you. And I think that there's expectations are not quite what you think they're going to be.
Can we talk for a moment about how obnoxious some of the other publishers are? in just that way where it's like, I'm sure Dave gets this too. It's like every other day you get an email that's like, hi, I've heard that you're a person, you're perfect for our new book, you know, the WordPress admin 8.1, or I don't know, just some stupid, you know, like they throw darts everywhere that they can get. They're like recruiters, but trying to get people to write books. And I'm like, that's how you get people to write books for you? That seems
well, it's a different business model. I mean, I don't want to like say it's bad or good. I mean, the people who own those companies are going to be retiring a lot sooner than I am, but, it's kind of like the venture capitalist model. You sign 100 books and you basically print them and you put them in your catalog. That's how you promote them. And some of those books are going to do well. Maybe 5 of them do well because the authors are really good and they were really good at doing all the promotional and marketing work. And those 5 carry the day and make you some money at the end of the year, and the other 95 be damned. And that's why a lot of those...
And somehow that doesn't hurt your brand.
I think it hurts the brand. But, you know, I mean, I'm shocked at times that some of these publishers will even sign multiple authors to write multiple books on the same topic at the same time, which is unconscionable in my book.
Yeah, I have friends who, well, I'm writing the fifth book for this publisher on, you know, HTML. Like that will release this year. And it's just poor authors. It's like you, I don't know, are at a conference and everyone else is talking about the same topic before you.
I listened to some podcast about the film company that made that movie Paranormal Activity, and it's like their business model too is to like just make a ton of really cheap movies, and sometimes they do super well, and apparently it's like it was super smart, and now Hollywood's trying to copy them or whatever. Maybe one of them is big, maybe not. Yeah, it's like the venture capital model, as you said.
I think I also wonder about the experience that authors have in that scenario. Like, if they're writing for a big publisher like that and they're writing something that is being written by three other people, or it's one in 100 books that are being put out in a year, like, is that fun? I have to imagine that it's not. And I think that, you know, for us, that's a big thing that we think about as well, is like, we really enjoy doing this. I think it comes through. I think it's why we put a lot of emphasis on putting out good quality product. And we also want this to be a thing that people might consider doing again, whether it's for us or not, and have a really good experience doing it.
Amen to that. I mean, you know, it's important to take pride in what you do. It would be hard to be in our particular field, our collectively field, if we didn't take pride. I'd be really sad if, you know, people were publishing in this space or doing any kind of work in this space and had no pride in work. I mean, I'll just tell you what Tim O'Reilly told me when I was starting out. I mean, I'm an O'Reilly author, and they're about as good as you can get for traditional publishing companies. And he said, "Oh, you're going into publishing. You're like me. Frustrated authors become publishers." And you know, I just think we need maybe more frustrated authors out there, because the Book Apart and Rosenfeld Media, we're doing our best. We can't do maybe all the books that need to happen. I don't know. Maybe that's debatable. We need more people who really take pride in what they're doing when it comes to books. And self-publishing is an avenue there. I just don't know if it's a scalable avenue. So I don't know. I would welcome more companies like ours in this space.
Well, that sounds like a pretty great place to end it. You got some wrap-up stuff, Dave?
Yeah, well, thank you both for coming on the show and also suffering through my endless book proposals. I really appreciate that. But before we go, how can people follow you, give you money, and what's one thing you'd like to plug before you go?
We're rosenfeldmedia.com and Rosenfeld Media on Twitter. I'm Lewis Rosenfeld on Twitter. I would love people to take a look at our catalog of books. We've got many, many in the pipeline. It's starting to get a little crazy, so I have to put a break on some of it. But we have lots of books on the way. And we also have a good conference coming up pretty soon, enterpriseux.net. And hope to see some of you there.
Thank you. And that Donna Lichaw episode, if you want to listen to that, it's just a few episodes back. Listen to it. I haven't stopped thinking about it. So I'm just going to piggyback your plug. But Cattell, where can people
find you? We're at abookapart.com. We're also at abookapart on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, where we're starting to post a few more photos about where people are reading and how they read, which is kind of fun. And we've had quite a few releases this year already, Get for Humans, Design for Real Life, and the two brief books that I mentioned, CSS Grid, Get Ready for CSS Grid Layout, and Pricing Design, which are really awesome. And we've got a bunch of stuff in the works, two other brief books that we will release very soon and we're very excited about. So you can also sign up for our newsletter on our site and you get information there.
All right. And I'm actually working through the Designing for Touch by Josh Clark. And the first like 5 pages, I was like, I have too many ideas. It's really great.
That one's a great one.
All right. Well, thank you both for coming on the show. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this and your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star heart, favorite it up, tweet about the show. That's how people find out. We really appreciate that. It helps keep things going, keeps the old money train going. Thanks. And episode train. We really appreciate that. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new job, or just pitch a book. It's that easy. Chris, you got anything else? Yeah, asterisk. Whole episode. Chris, you got anything?
Shoptalkshow.